From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. To cap off the Democratic National Convention week, a new political thriller with the presidential campaign as a backdrop opens in theaters. It's The Manchurian Candidate, a remake of the original 1962 film. On today's Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with John Frankenheimer, who directed the original, and from Angela Lansbury, who starred in it. Also, we hear from Liev Schreiber, one of the stars of the remake, and David Edelstein, who reviews this new version of The Manchurian Candidate. Also, we consider the TV coverage of the Democratic National Convention, or the lack of it. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The president's national security advisors met again today to discuss his response to the 9/11 Commission's report. They say their recommendations for intelligence reform may go even further than the changes that panel has sought. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly reports.
The White House has praised the 9/11 report as an important document. But today, a senior White House official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said she was staggered by how quickly some people are endorsing the proposals without taking time to reflect. The official wouldn't reveal what the president's thinking about specific changes like creating a national intelligence director. She did say he's concerned about finding ways to protect civil liberties while also protecting national security. From his ranch in Texas this week, President Bush has led three video conference calls to discuss the 9/11 report. The senior official says the president is still reading it. I can't tell you exactly what page he's on, she said, but he intends to read it all the way through. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR News, Washington.
At the Democratic National Convention last night, John Kerry's fellow Vietnam veterans vouched for his ability to handle terrorism and the war in Iraq. As NPR's Chris Arnold reports, national security was a big issue for many people reflecting on Kerry's speech on the streets of Boston today.
At an outdoor cafe, a mutual fund manager who is also named John Kerry is eating lunch, only this Kerry spells his name with a C, and he's a Republican.
Well, I'm one of the people, I guess, who isn't convinced by the Democrats' commitment to national security. And even if you look at Kerry's own voting record, he voted for the war, but against the appropriation. His record has been more on the pacifist side, I would say.
But iron worker Robert McLean, who's a Democrat, says he liked what Kerry had to say about knowing what to do in Iraq and how he wouldn't mislead the country into war.
I have a son in Fallujah right now. You know, he could get killed. And he's fighting for a worthless cause, I believe. I know Kerry voted for, the war effort, but I don't think he got all the facts.
Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
Government officials in Uzbekistan say suicide bombers attacked the U.S. and Israeli embassies in Tashkent today, as well as the office of the government's top prosecutor. A government spokesman said two Uzbek guards were killed outside the Israeli embassy and two were injured at the U.S. embassy. Seven people were wounded in the attack on the prosecutor's office. The attackers struck all three locations at nearly the same time. Uzbekistan has been a U.S. ally in the war on terror. An Islamic militant group posted a message on the internet claiming responsibility for the attack and threatening further violence. In stocks today, the Dow gained 10 points to close at 10,139 in active trading. The Nasdaq was up 6 to 1887. This is NPR News. Russian authorities have given the embattled oil giant Yukos a one-month reprieve to pay billions of dollars in back taxes. NPR's Lawrence Sheets reports from Moscow.
At the beginning of this week, it looked like Yukos faced having its prize assets sold off to meet the multi-billion-dollar tax bill in just a matter of days. The tax reprieve gives Russia's biggest oil company a glimmer of hope. But it's not clear if Yukos can come up with enough cash in time to avoid being divvied up among companies loyal to the Kremlin. Yukos was once run by Russia's richest man, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who's now standing trial on tax evasion and fraud charges. The case against Khodorkovsky and Yukos is seen by some observers as Kremlin retaliation for the tycoon's brash political ambitions. It's also regarded as a warning to Russia's rich oligarchs to stay out of politics, or risk losing the empires that many of them built up through the use of dubious business practices. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News, Moscow.
The White House is now predicting that the federal government will spend $445 billion more than it will take in this fiscal year. And Joshua Bolton, the head of the Office of Management and Budget, says part of the deficit stems from the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
The president, just a couple few months ago, made an additional $25 billion request for emergency spending in Iraq for fiscal 05.
The deficit is about $76 billion lower than the White House was predicting earlier this year. Democrats have charged that Bolton's office overestimated the deficit then in order to have it appear lower during the presidential campaign. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Discovery Channel, presenting Columbus, Secrets from the Grave, The Mystery of Columbus's True Identity, Sunday, August 1st at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Democratic National Convention ended last night. The Republicans get their turn on TV next month. Meanwhile, in the movies, a political convention figures in the plot of The Manchurian Candidate, a new movie remake starring Denzel Washington, now in theaters. On today's Fresh Air, we'll revisit the original controversial 1962 Manchurian Candidate and replay interviews with the late director John Frankenheimer, with Angela Lansbury, who played the part Meryl Streep plays in the new version, and with co-star Liev Schreiber. We'll also have film critic David Edelstein's review of the remake. But first, let's look at political conventions and drama on the small screen, and how and where the Democratic National Convention played out. On commercial broadcast TV, the convention show was more like a no-show. Half of the networks, Fox, UPN, and the WB, didn't cover the convention at all. Even the major networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC, each devoted only 3 hours over four nights to primetime coverage. They decided beforehand that Tuesday night wasn't worth showing at all. And by making that decision in advance, they missed one of the most riveting and significant events of the entire Democratic convention, the keynote speech by rising Democratic star Barack Obama, which turned him instantly into a major future political player. If you saw the speech live, you were witness to a bit of history, and not an insignificant bit. But to see it, you had to be watching PBS or tuned to cable. C-SPAN, which shows everything gavel to gavel, presented Obama's entire speech. So did CNN, MSNBC, Fox News Channel, and even ABC News Now, the brand new digitally streamed news operation from ABC. Peter Jennings did a lot of good work there at this convention, but very little of it was seen on his main over-the-air network. Jennings could even be seen yesterday on CNN, interviewed by former ABC colleague Anderson Cooper. He was defending his passion for the American political process and attacking his own network's decision to televise so little of it.
You just come back from Iraq. Does it, having been there, does it change the way you look at this, the way you look at this process at all? I mean, does it, I mean, for me, it actually kind of made me, I think it's easy to be cynical about this process, easy to be cynical about what's happening here.
Oh, I bet it made you feel romantic about it.
It did, in a way, yeah.
Well, you see, you and I have similar experiences. We've both been in many, many parts of the world where power is exchanged on the barrel of a gun. Right. Some guy brings up his tank and the government changes. That still happens in many parts of the world. In the time I served overseas, it happened all the time. So I think when you come home and participate in the democratic process, even vicariously as journalists do, I think it's extraordinarily moving.
Do the networks, broadcast networks, you guys have gotten a bad rap lately. I mean, you're broadcasting 3 hours of coverage all this
week.
It's
not enough.
Though you're doing this digital television, which I want to talk about in a moment. It's not enough.
No, of course not. When Barack Obama was on the television the other night.
Yeah, it wasn't carried live by the networks.
I know. Our network, I'm sorry to say, was in a rerun of a program that I don't know which one it was. But
Does it embarrass you?
No, it actually makes me a little angry. And that's why, on the other hand.
The rerun to which Jennings was referring, by the way, was a repeat of the canceled sitcom I'm With Her. Viewers who don't subscribe to cable and didn't turn to public television saw less live convention coverage this week than at any time in TV history. That history began in 1948, when both CBS and NBC offered to East Coast stations live coverage of the three national political conventions from Philadelphia. Back then, they even covered the Progressive Party. Political conventions today are tightly scripted and controlled, and major events that used to happen at conventions, like the choosing of candidates, now happen months beforehand. Yet we can learn a lot from the way each party chooses its speakers and crafts its image, and who is and isn't considered a ready-for-primetime player. And no matter how firmly things are controlled, there always will be surprises. Like Barack Obama, Al Sharpton, and lurking in the shadows, getting more TV time at this convention than most politicians, Ben Affleck, and especially Michael Moore. On Tuesday, when Moore showed up on the Fox News Channel to swap questions with Bill O'Reilly on The O'Reilly Factor, it was big news and drew more viewers than any other moment of convention coverage that night. By Thursday, another Michael Moore sighting was just that, one more sighting. I watched the convention on 12 TV screens, each tuned to a different network, and at times it seemed like Michael Moore was crawling out of one screen directly into another. The one I remember most, though, is his exchange with host Ted Koppel on ABC's Nightline.
Do you feel just a little bit uncomfortable about the influence that you may have on this election?
No, not at all. I'm glad to participate. I'm glad to offer this. You know, geez, I feel very lucky, Ted, to be able to make this contribution. You know, growing up in Flint, Michigan, I have a high school education. I'm never would expect to be sitting here even talking to you. I mean,
life is amazing, isn't it? God, well, the things you get to do in this country.
Yeah, well, that's why we love it, isn't it? You know, some people get to be Ted Koppel, and some people get to talk to Ted Koppel. I love this country.
I mean, after you make your next 100 million, are you going to shave?
After I make the next 100 million, I'll be Ted Koppel.
You wouldn't want that.
Both of the segments I've chosen from this year's convention coverage feature members of the media talking to one another. There were more of those this week than I've ever seen before, going so far down the journalistic food chain that TV reporters spent way too much time interviewing bloggers, internet writers of informal diaries. One blogger, interviewed on ABC News Now, reported, and I quote, "VIP room, cash bar, what's up with that?" The networks have a month until the Republican National Convention at the end of August to get it right, but they won't. Even if only to be fair, the networks will approach the Republicans pretty much the same way and for the same paltry amount of live primetime coverage. 6 networks, 3 hours. What's up with that? I'm David Bean Cooley. The Manchurian Candidate, Jonathan Demme's remake of the gripping political thriller from 1962, opens today in theaters. Denzel Washington plays Ben Marco, a Gulf War veteran plagued by disturbing dreams. Liev Schreiber plays Raymond Shaw, another member of Marco's unit during the Gulf War, who is now an up-and-coming young congressman from New York. And Meryl Streep plays Shaw's ambitious mother, Eleanor, whose husband Johnny, Shaw's stepfather, is also running for office on the ticket for president. The original movie, made in the aftermath of the McCarthy-era witch hunts and in the early volatile years of the Cold War, starred Frank Sinatra as the troubled Marco, the role now played by Denzel, Lawrence Harvey as war hero Raymond Shaw, and Angela Lansbury as Shaw's mother. The movie was directed by John Frankenheimer, who died in 2002 at age 72. Let's get a taste of the original. In this scene, Raymond Shaw, played by Lawrence Harvey, is touring his stepfather Johnny's new campaign plane. Angela Lansbury, as Shaw's mother, is showing off the plane, but her son doesn't intend to stay on it.
I'm not going home with you, Mother. I'm going to New York.
What?
I've got a job in a newspaper. Research assistant to Mr. Hoban Gaines.
Hoban Gaines? That communist?
He's not a communist, Mother. As a matter of fact, he's a Republican.
But the terrible things he's written about Johnny.
He came to interview me at the White House this morning. Afterwards, I asked him for a job. He gave it to me. We discovered that we had a great deal in common.
What could you possibly have in common with that dreadful old man?
Well, for one thing, we discovered that we both loathe and despise you and Johnny. And that's the beginning.
John Frankenheimer started his career in TV in the 1950s, directing such golden age TV dramas as the classic Days of Wine and Roses for Playhouse 90. His films included The Birdman of Alcatraz, 7 Days in May, French Connection 2, Black Sunday, and more recently, Ronin and Reindeer Games. Terry spoke with Frankenheimer in 1990.
There's a scene I have to ask you about. It's really an extraordinary scene. This is the Garden Club dream scene. Frank Sinatra is having these recurring nightmares in which he's with all of the men from his army troop from the Korean War. He's with them at a ladies' garden club, and suddenly the ladies' garden club turns into a lot of Korean soldiers, and the head Korean soldier is discussing how he's brainwashing these soldiers into believing that they're at a garden party. And then to show how brainwashed they really are, he has Lawrence Harvey just walk over and strangle to death one of the men. You shot that scene in such a disorienting way. The camera just kind of revolves around all the women of the garden club first, and then suddenly the women are transformed into men, and you're as confused as Frank Sinatra is by all of this. Tell me about how you decided to shoot this scene.
Well, number one, the idea of the scene came right out of Richard Condon's book. He described pretty well what the scene should look like. So it was up to me to interpret it. And the shot that you're talking about is a 360-degree shot, which starts on the stage of a hotel in New Jersey where a woman is talking about hydrangeas, and we pan around the room, and you think that it's just women listening to this, a garden club. And then as the camera completes its 360-degree arc, you suddenly find yourself on a stage in an amphitheater in Korea, and the Chinese psychiatrist is talking about brainwashing. So what we did was we designed a set that could be moved, and it took a little athletic ability from the actors to run from one platform to the other while we were back on the garden club. And the two platforms were on a kind of a railroad track, and we slid one right in place as the camera moved off the first one. But what it did was it set in the audience's mind that this was not just the magic in the movies, that something very strange here was happening, because we never cut. And the audience realizes when you cut. They might not know what it is, but they know that there's been some mechanical device put between them and the story. And I wanted to do it all in one shot. And I think after we accomplished that shot, then we were able to cut to anything that we wanted to do. And we filmed that sequence with about seven or eight different combinations. The women in Korea, the Chinese Manchurian delegates in New Jersey, the actors on the New Jersey stage hotel, the actors in the Korean amphitheater. And we were able to intercut it at will, back and forth. And after the first shot, the suspension of disbelief with the audience was complete. So we were able to kind of manipulate them back and forth whenever we wanted to. And you're right, we did cut it in such a way that it was confusing, and deliberately so.
Now, one of the black men from this same troop that Sinatra was in has the same dream. But when he has the dream, all of the women from the ladies' club are black. Was that in the novel, or is that your invention, to have the two people have their own version of this same dream?
That was me. What I never did do, I had it done, but I just didn't dare take the shot of it. In the back of the room, we had a white bellboy. But we never did show it. If you look carefully, you can see it.
That's great. It's a wonderful. It's wonderful the way you contrast the two dreams.
You know, I want to tell you one other thing about that movie. That's something that I don't think people are aware of, but I think it's important to say in these days and times, which is that was one of the first movies where the producer and director used a black actor to play a part that was not written for a black. Today it's done quite often, but that was very new at the time, to take the black actor, cast him as the psychiatrist. And that part was not written for a black actor. I've since done it quite a bit, but I just wanted to bring that up.
You were the co-producer of the movie. I assume that means that you were one of the people who were behind making it, as opposed to a director who was brought on after the idea.
Yes.
Was already in effect.
Yes. In this particular case, George Axelrod and I bought the book. We developed it, and then I ended up directing it, of course.
How did Sinatra get involved with the movie?
Well, Sinatra was the whole element that made the movie possible. The movie had been turned down by every studio in town. And when George Axelrod and I bought the book, we bought it by buying the book in a bookstore. It had been optioned and re-optioned and dropped and never been able to be made. And we knew that Frank Sinatra had read the book and Frank Sinatra was interested in the picture, but he had never really gone the whole nine yards and optioned it. So we optioned it, and without a script, Frank Sinatra committed to it. And, of course, by the right away, as soon as he committed to it, we had the necessary financing to make the movie.
Did you have any idea he'd be as good as he was in it? I mean, did you have as much faith in his acting abilities when you started?
No. I didn't want to make the movie with Frank Sinatra. I was scared of it. I had heard he was very difficult. I had heard that he treated directors badly, all those things. I expressed these reservations to George Axelrod, and he said, look, he said, I'm going to make the movie with Frank Sinatra, whether you do it or whether you don't. He said, I'll buy you out, but I want to make this movie with Sinatra. Sinatra's going to get this picture made. And if you have problems with Sinatra, he said, I would suggest that you discuss them with him instead of discussing them with me. And I made an appointment to see Mr. Sinatra. I went up to see him at his house, and I expressed my reservations to him. And he said, look, I guarantee you, whether what you've heard is true, whether what you've heard is not true, there is my side to all that, too. He said, I want to do this picture, I want to work with you, and I feel that we're going to get along just fine. And that was the last discussion we ever had. We got along absolutely fabulously. I loved working with Frank Sinatra.
You've done several films about the military, 7 Days in May, The Manchurian Candidate. You went to military school as a child, right?
Yes, it's true.
Did you feel like that gave you insights into the military mind at all?
Yes, I do. And I also was a lieutenant in the Air Force, and I was General LeMay's personal photographer during the Korean War and things like that. And yes, I do. I feel that it's given me a tremendous insight into the military mind, especially on higher levels, because I was around general officers a lot. And it's helped me.
When you were General LeMay's personal photographer during the Korean War, what did that entail?
Well, it entailed photographing the general quite a bit. It entailed
right.
It entailed also doing some training films. I was in the Air Photographic Squadron that did a lot of training films in the United States. That's how I started, actually.
Started making movies.
Yeah.
John Frankenheimer, director of the original Manchurian Candidate, speaking to Terry Gross in 1990. He died in 2002 at age 72. Coming up, one of the stars of that 1962 film, Angela Lansbury. This is Fresh Air. The Manchurian Candidate, Jonathan Demme's remake of John Frankenheimer's 1962 film, opens today. It stars Denzel Washington as Ben Marco, the role originally played by Frank Sinatra, and Meryl Streep as the power-hungry Eleanor Shaw, the role first played by Angela Lansbury. Terry Gross spoke with Lansbury in 2000 about her work in that film.
You made The Manchurian Candidate in 1962, and in this movie, a terrific movie, you're a manipulative, domineering mother and wife who's trying to promote the political career of your husband. And it turns out you're actually part of a conspiracy to assassinate the political opponent and take over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And in this scene, you're telling your son, who has been brainwashed, that he has to be the assassin.
You are to shoot the presidential nominee through the head. And Johnny will rise gallantly to his feet and lift Ben Arthur's body in his arms, and stand in front of the microphones and begin to speak. The speech is short, but it's the most rousing speech I've ever read. It's been worked on here and in Russia, on and off for over 8 years. I shall force someone to take the body away from him. Then Johnny will really hit those microphones and those cameras with blood all over him, fighting off anyone who tries to help him, defending America even if it means his own death, rallying a nation of television viewers into hysteria to sweep us up into the White House with powers that will make martial law seem like anarchy. Now, this is very important. I want the nominee to be dead about 2 minutes after he begins his acceptance speech, depending on his reading time under pressure. You are to hit him right at the point that he finishes the phrase. Nor would I ask of any fellow American, in defense of his freedom, that which I would not gladly give myself. My life before my liberty. Is that absolutely clear?
Wow. And at the end
well
of that scene,
speech.
Yes. And at the end of that scene, before you send your son off to kill the candidate, you kiss him on each cheek, then kiss him fully on the mouth.
Oh, yes.
How'd you feel about that scene?
Oh, I thought it was very telling. Very telling.
And how'd you feel about playing such a really evil role?
They are the best. Any actress will tell you that evil roles to play are the best. You can go to town, you know. And in that instance, I think that woman had so many layers and so many personas, in a sense. She was riveting and so interesting to play. I relish the having had that opportunity to play that role, because I don't think there are many written like that. I consider that she was the Lear among, you know, movie women.
We've talked about your long and really wonderful career on stage and screen. I think some of our listeners will know you best from television for your work on Murder, She Wrote as Jessica Fletcher, who has solved God knows how many murders over the years that you did that show. Did you ever count how many murders you solved?
264.
Oh, really?
Yes.
You know, the press release for the Kennedy Center Honor describes you as a beloved actress, which I think is pretty accurate. But do you feel beloved?
from playing Jessica Fletcher, yes, I do. I do feel a sense of tremendous warmth from the American public who have known and loved that program. I really do. I know they I don't know whether they're mixing me up with a character, and it really doesn't matter. The main thing is I feel their gratitude so often for all the nights.
Well, I guess a role like in The Manchurian Candidate doesn't earn you the word beloved, actually.
No, it certainly does.
Fantastic,
not.
Fantastic, maybe, but not beloved.
No, it takes a show like Murder, She Wrote, I think, to bring that enormous audience to one and to make them aware of who you are and what you've done, you know?
Angela Lansbury speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. Jonathan Demme's remake of The Manchurian Candidate opens today. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from TIAA Cref, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we feature an interview with Liev Schreiber. He stars in the remake of The Manchurian Candidate. And we have a review of the film from critic David Edelstein. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. Liev Schreiber stars in the new version of The Manchurian Candidate as war hero Raymond Shaw, the role played in the 1962 version by Lawrence Harvey. Here's a scene from the original movie, in which Ben Marco, played by Frank Sinatra, complains to his former commanding officer about a series of bad dreams. Douglas Henderson plays the CO.
Mickey, listen to me, please. For the last 6 months, I've been driven nearly out of my mind by the same recurring dream.
The medical officer in charge.
What the hell does the medical corps know about intelligence work, Milt? I tell you, there's something phony going on. There's something phony about me, about Raymond Shaw, about the whole Medal of Honor business. For instance, when the psychiatrist asked me how I felt about Raymond Shaw, how I personally felt about him, and how the whole patrol felt about him, did you hear what I said? Did you really hear what I said? I said Raymond Shaw is the kindest, warmest, bravest, most wonderful human being I've ever known in my life. And even now I feel that way, this minute. And yet, somewhere in the back of my mind, something tells me it's not true. It's just not true. It isn't as if Raymond's hard to like. He's impossible to like. In fact, he's probably one of the most repulsive human beings I've ever known in my whole, all of my life.
And what I came to tell you is public relations has bounced you back to me. And in your present state, there's no possible way I can use you. As of this moment, I'm placing you on indefinite sick leave. Go away, Ben. Find yourself a girl. Lie in the sun.
I absolutely refuse.
Now, in this scene from the new movie, Marco is played by Denzel Washington. He's trying to describe his bad dreams and concerns to Raymond Shaw, played by Liev Schreiber.
There are these dreams that some of the men from our unit have been having.
Including you?
Well, it's more of a question of what actually happened the night that our patrol got attacked.
Am I in your dreams, Captain? Yes, you are, Congressman. Saving everybody.
It's a whole lot more complicated than that. Now, Corporal Melvin, he's been drawing these pictures and he wrote down what he dreams. And maybe if you
I
just
don't
take...
have dreams, Captain.
At all? You mean you don't dream at all? Everybody dreams,
but,
right?
Captain, I'd like to help you. I would. I really would. But
if you,
I think you ought to see somebody. Somebody who specializes.
I've been to doctors.
Well, good. That's very good, because they can probably help you out a lot more than I can.
I don't know, but...
Take care, Captain.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming by.
Okay.
Terry spoke to Liev Schreiber in 1999 from his home in Manhattan. She started with his 1996 film, The Day Trippers.
This is a really funny film, and your character in this is a would-be novelist.
Mm-hmm.
Your girlfriend is played by Parker Posey. And in this scene, you're in a car with her whole family, her sister, who's just found a letter indicating her husband is probably having an affair, and their parents. The mother is played by Ann Mira. And in this scene, Parker Posey is explaining to her parents that you're writing a novel.
It's far out. It's brilliant.
I don't think your parents want to hear my novel.
Mom and Dad, do you want to hear about Carl's novel?
Oh, yeah. Sure, Carl.
Well, Rita, it's an allegory about spiritual survival in the contemporary world. The main character is this freak of nature. He's this man who doesn't have a normal head. He was born with a dog's head.
A dog's head?
Yeah, you know, sort of a fantastical story.
It's like a fable.
Yeah, like Master and Margarita or...
Animal Farm.
Animal, yeah, exactly. Very Kafka-esque.
Carl, I'm not an educated woman.
It's Dr. Seuss for adults, Mom.
Oh yeah.
So, everyone else in the book is normal, except for the man with the dog's head, who really only wants...
What kind of dog?
Dad, it's not important.
No. It is important. Actually, that's very important. It's a German short-haired pointer. You see, it's actually especially important that it's a pointer, because that's a crucial metaphor, because in the book, he's sort of a visionary, you know? You know, pointing the way to salvation.
You're really funny in that scene, and I think this kind of pretentious would-be writer is probably a familiar character to you. You probably have met many of people you could have based this on.
Yeah. Greg Mottola is the guy who's my best friend, who wrote Day Trippers and directed it. Has a good dose of Carl in him, actually.
Oh.
Yeah. But much more refined.
Tell me more about this character for you.
When they initially gave me this script, I guess I kind of did have a reputation for playing kind of awkward characters or sort of weird characters, and I guess in to some extent, it's probably because I identify with them, and I think ultimately audiences probably do as well. I don't believe that we identify with the romantic lead. I think that we want to love them or take care of them, but I think that all of us, out of our insecurity, tend to identify with the other guy. And Carl, to me, was a terrific example of that, because here was a guy who was a completely obnoxious, pain in the butt all the time. So what was redeeming about him? What was interesting about him? Because you're going to, obviously, if you're going to play this part, you're going to get a lot of good gags. You're going to get a lot of good gags in which you can make a lot of jokes at the character's expense. But is there something about him that we can identify with? And what I really loved about Carl was that everything that Carl was doing that was obnoxious was in the service of being liked.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And that's all he really wanted. He really just wanted to be liked. Uh-huh. He wanted people to like him, which is something that I think we can all identify with. I mean, the ludicrous things that we do on a daily basis just because we want to impress somebody or we want somebody to love us. I thought it was a tremendously sweet gesture from that character. Everything that he did that was so obnoxious to me seemed wonderfully sweet.
Let's go to another scene of yours. This is from Scream 2, in which you play Cotton, the character who's done time for murders that he didn't commit. And at the beginning of Scream 2, he's released from prison, and a TV reporter played by Courtney Cox kind of brings him to the character who he had been, you know, accused of terrorizing, Neve Campbell. And she wants to interview them both together, and Neve Campbell is just appalled that something so insensitive could be happening here. So she leaves. Later, he catches up with her in the library and insists that they do an interview together because he's gotten this great offer from Diane Sawyer.
Who calls me out of the blue? But Diane Sawyer. Believe me, Sid, I was as shocked as you are. Anyway, she tells me that if you and I go on the air together, she will give us the entire hour.
What?
We're talking prime time, Sid. You, me, and Diane Sawyer.
Cotton, I can't.
Look, this is about money. It's not like we're not getting paid, yeah. Okay? There's $10,000 each, not to mention what I've got going on the side with a 900 number.
But Cotton.
I know. You don't like the press. I know that, and I respect it, Sidney. But, Sidney, it's Diane Sawyer. Hello. She's a class act, Sidney. This could be some very, very heavy exposure. I'm sorry.
Look, between the movie and the book, people know the truth. Let's get on with our lives. There's been enough exposure. Why would you want any more?
Why? No, I don't know, Sidney. I don't know. Maybe because I f***ing deserve a little exposure. I mean, come on, Sidney. You drag my name through the mud. Everybody thinks I'm some kind of psycho killer. And all I'm asking for is one little f***ing Diane Sawyer interview to maybe get my side of the story straight. Now, I don't think I'm being unreasonable in that request, Sidney. Do you honestly...
That's Leah Schreiber and Neve Campbell from Scream 2. This is a really funny role, and you're playing a character who we don't know how psycho he really is in the audience. Uh-huh. You know, uh-huh. We don't know how crazy he is or just how frustrated he is from being wronged.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's like very compelling, but you're speaking in a pretty quiet voice in this scene as opposed to the kind of shouting and ranting you might expect.
Mm-hmm. Well, I, you know, what I think is was so phenomenal about the whole Scream series is that Wes and Kevin Williamson...
The director and
Wes
writer.
Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson, the director and writer. What we were trying to do in those films that I think really worked well and was a great idea was to sort of take people's expectations of the genre, of the horror suspense genre, and kind of turn them around, give the audience a little credit for their intelligence. I mean, it's the most predictable medium. Really, it has become that, I think, you know, watch out behind you kind of thing, and was to sort of take these cliches and try and, make them a little more interesting. And, you know, the idea of the guy who's been stewing in jail, who served time for a crime he didn't commit and now wants vengeance, is that, you know, it already sets you up, so you kind of want to play against it, I think, or find an angle that's more interesting. And to me, what was interesting about it at the time we were making it, and still is this kind of, you know, media circus that goes on in the world today, is that everybody has their 15 minutes of fame and they're trying really hard to make sure it's a good 15 minutes. And what to me was funny as a motivation for Cotton was that, you know, here everybody was getting famous off these murders and he was doing time. So he figured it was time for him to get his 15 minutes. And
Did you like horror films as a kid?
I hated them.
Why?
I still hate them because they scare the piss out of me. And I hate being scared. Yeah. It was interesting when I did the first one, I really just walked down some stairs, and I did it as a favor for a friend who worked for Miramax and Dimension at the time. He said, "Well, you know, will you just do this?" And I said, "Yeah, well, are you sure?" It was the easiest money I ever made. I walked down some stairs for 20 minutes. And afterwards, the writer came up to me, Kevin, and he said, "You know, I'm really glad you're doing this because we're planning a sequel." And I said, "Now, wait a minute. I don't want to do that." And they said, "Well, why? Why? It's really wonderful." I said, "Yeah, the script's wonderful and everything. I love it. But I don't want to be in horror movies. I don't like them. I don't like the violence. I don't want to kill anybody, and I don't like getting killed." And at that time, I'd been in a lot of movies where I was getting killed, and it was upsetting my mother and me that I was dying so often in films. So I had made a promise that I wouldn't die anymore. And in the second one, we put together this contract that it was very, very patient of them to put together, where I would say, "Well, I don't die, and I don't want to kill anybody." And sort of this impossible task of, well, then how do you act in a horror movie if you don't die and you don't want to kill people?
Liev Schreiber speaking with Terry Gross. He's co-starring in the remake of The Manchurian Candidate, which opens today. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's conversation with actor Liev Schreiber. He's co-starring in the remake of The Manchurian Candidate. When they spoke in 1999, Terry asked him about the film A Walk on the Moon. The story takes place in 1969, the summer of Woodstock and the first moonwalk. Schreiber plays a husband and father whose family vacations in a bungalow colony in the Catskills. In this scene, he finds out his wife is having an affair. She even went to Woodstock with the guy while her husband was working in the city.
Where'd you meet him?
He's a salesman.
Phew! This is great. It's like a Johnny Yoon routine. So is he a traveling salesman?
Sorta.
What's he sell?
Blouses.
Blouses. He's the blouse man. You're screwing the blouse man. Jesus, Pearl. Why don't you screw the dress man? At least that way you get a whole outfit, you know?
After a role like Walk on the Moon, I would think that you really understand what it's like to grow up in a pretty conventional middle class family. And then I was reading about you, and you didn't grow up in a conventional middle class family at all.
No.
Tell us something about your mother and the home that you grew up in.
Well, my mother and I moved to New York when I was about 5 years old, and my mother was a bit of an eccentric. She was an artist, and moving to New York for her, poverty was no problem. In fact, poverty was kind of an adventure for her. So we lived in, buildings without electricity and hot water. And my mother had jobs. She was a cab driver. She made papier-mâché puppets. She had a health food business. She did everything that she could, or everything that she wanted to make a living, and was kind of successful at it. What was so wonderful about Walk on the Moon was that. When Dustin and I met on Sphere, my grandfather, who had kind of been the father figure in my life, had passed away fairly recently, and I was very upset by that and still very kind of confused with it and processing it. And suddenly Dustin came to me with this script, and it was one of those sort of serendipitous moments where you are allowed to work something out through
through your job. And the character of Marty was essentially, in my mind, he just reminded me so much of my grandfather. And that kind of work ethic and that kind of life and that kind of relationship was something that I was familiar with through him. And
what kind of work did your grandfather do?
He delivered meat to diners, and he had a little van that I used to go out with him in the mornings, and he would deliver meat to like Jones Diner on Great Jones Street and Dubrow's up in the Fashion District, and it, you know, it was really hard work. But at the same time, my grandfather had this, you know, this blue collar job. He was also he also played the cello and collected art. So that kind of contradiction in character, which I thought was Marty as well, was he was a guy who really was very interested in science and wanted very much to pursue academia, but didn't have the opportunity because he was supporting his family and was incredibly loyal to his family and a real, I think, mensch is the perfect word for him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very much my grandfather.
How did you decide you wanted to act?
I think I was just one of those kids who early on in English class was always sort of volunteering to read the Shakespeare. I had, for one reason or another, taken to Shakespeare right away, and had always been good with language and was an early reader. And I think maybe in feeling a little bit like an outsider, growing up, being different and what have you, I think that I sort of leapt at the opportunity to assimilate. And for me, oddly enough, acting was assimilating. It was showing that you could act like everyone else. You could be normal. People could identify with you. You could make jokes. You could make people laugh. You could affect people's feelings, where socially you felt maybe you weren't. It wasn't as easy to do that. Through acting, it was not only easy, but it was safe. And it was also a tremendous amount of fun. And I thought, geez, you know, if I can get paid to do that, that'd be cake.
I think for most actors, like their faces and their bodies determine in part the roles that they're given, mm-hmm. the roles that they're allowed to play. How do you think the way you look has affected the roles that you've gotten?
I'm not sure. You know, it's changing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably what has served me best, ironically, is a certain amount of anonymity that I've enjoyed for the past 7 years, that people don't know who I am. And that's been great for me because it's allowed me to do a lot of different kind of characters. I think that one of the problems with Hollywood that I've never had to come up against and probably will now, I'll probably be playing Orson Welles type characters for the next year or so, is that you are as good as your last role. And because I've been able to do kind of supporting roles and smaller character parts and have not really done any press to speak of until this past year, it's really allowed me to do a lot of different kinds of things, which has just been wonderful.
Yeah, you've said in one interview that there's two different kinds of full-time jobs. One is celebrity and the other is actor.
Yeah.
Have you met a lot of celebrity actors who, for whom you think celebrity has really interfered with their ability to act?
I think it can interfere with your ability to act because what happens is you have to... celebrity really is a full-time job if you choose to pursue it. And then part of pursuing it is embracing the character that the press has assigned you. And that in itself is acting. And if you spend all of your time doing that character, your range is decreased, and the acceptance of the public to see you as anything else is also very limited. And I think that, you know, it's like the thing I was saying before about playing character in general, is that audiences want to go to a theater, I believe, and become the characters in the film. They want to identify with the characters in the film. And I think the more you define yourself outside of being an actor, as being a personality or as a celebrity, the more difficult it is for them to identify with the character you're playing in the film or in the play. And there's the sad part of that is that it kind of then they lose their ability to identify with you as the character. And whereas we may want to watch the celebrity and we may fantasize about having some sort of relationship with that celebrity, ultimately we're not as connected to the story because we're just watching the celebrity and not participating in the story ourselves.
Well, Liev Schreiber, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Liev Schreiber, speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. He's starring in the new remake of The Manchurian Candidate. Coming up, a review of that film. This is Fresh Air. In 1962, Richard Condon's novel The Manchurian Candidate became the basis for a wildly controversial thriller by John Frankenheimer, starring Frank Sinatra, Lawrence Harvey, and Angela Lansbury. Now, in time for campaign season, director Jonathan Demme, renowned for such movies as Melvin and Howard and The Silence of the Lambs, gives us an update, starring Denzel Washington and Meryl Streep. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Like many of you, I imagine, when I heard someone was remaking The Manchurian Candidate, I let out one of those long groans. The John Frankenheimer original from Richard Condon's novel is not just one of the great dynamic American thrillers, but a movie that was indelibly early 60s, when fear of communists collided with revulsion for the red-baiting Senator Joseph McCarthy, when brainwashing and the bomb and 50s ultra-sensitive mama's boys and Freudian monster mamas all coalesced into the freakiest paranoid melodrama the country had ever seen. And it came out during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when people's heads were already messed up. So, could a big-budget studio movie in 2004 have anything like that crazy audacity? Not even close. The remake doesn't have the same cynical flamboyance, and it doesn't make you sick with dread. But it's still an excellent melodrama. What it has is a passionate conviction. In the hands of the director, Jonathan Demme, the new Manchurian Candidate is a thriller with some of Fahrenheit 9/11's fire in the belly and an aura of tragedy to go with it. The terrible new threat isn't Reds or terrorists, but multinational conglomerates, which function, as a recent documentary called The Corporation contends, with the same level of conscience as a textbook psychopath. The Manchurian of the title is now Manchurian Global, a corporation obviously modeled on Halliburton, down to the no-bid contracts. And the title character is different. In the original, it's the buffoonish, McCarthy-like vice presidential nominee, groomed to win the presidency when his brainwashed stepson assassinates his running mate. Now that stepson, the alleged war hero Raymond Shaw, this time of Desert Storm, is himself the Manchurian candidate. That's good and bad. Good because it upends much of what we recall from the original, so that at every turn, Demme and his screenwriters are playing with our expectations. It's bad because Demme and the actor, Liev Schreiber, haven't rethought the character. He's, if anything, an even more charmless, abrasive rich boy, and the method actress Schreiber doesn't bother to make him a plausible politician, thus blowing the chance for some good, nasty satire in this convention season. But the other parts are played to the hilt, and in the case of Meryl Streep as Raymond's mother, now herself a God and country conservative senator, the hilt above the hilt.
This is about my son and the future of this country.
I thought we understood each other.
I think we do. I think we really do. Your God is money.
Oh, and yours is?
No, I'm a believer. I am an optimist. I believe in the future. And people who do, the ones who make history instead of just sitting around watching it, no, they're willing to take the big risks.
Yes, I made a decision.
Oh, God, where are all the men anymore? My father, Tyler Prentice, never asked, is this okay? Is this okay? You know what I'm saying, Mark? He just did what needed to be done.
As you can hear, Streep substitutes high-wire theatrical energy for Angela Lansbury's simmering inner demonism, and the performance is as over-the-top hilarious as Streep used to be on stage before jitters drove her full-time to the screen. The way she spits out the description of the liberal Senator Jordan, played by John Voight, as a one-worlder had me screaming, and she stops the movie just by crunching down on some ice cubes with a mixture of savagery and insouciance. The work of Denzel Washington as Army Major Ben Marco is in a completely different key. The actor who won an Oscar for his charismatic grandstanding in Training Day is here a messed-up, mumbling shell of a man, his eyes pulling back in anguish while from his mouth come things that someone in the desert of Kuwait programmed him to say. He doesn't yet know who and how and why. I've never seen this cock-of-the-walk actor hit such notes of helplessness. The role must have cost him something, and it's a personal triumph. It's also a testament to Jonathan Demme's humanism. Maybe Demme isn't enough of a sadist to make a thriller that brutally works you over, and the movie does slacken and go a little soft in the climax. But the dread with which it's permeated almost compensates. The scenes of the soldiers in Raymond's old squadron, who know that something's in their heads, but not what, give the whole film the feel of a post-traumatic stress disorder nightmare, a bad dream of good men losing their minds and bodies, while the powerful look on with monstrous indifference. No, it's not the twisted, sexy, tragicomic dynamite of 1962. It's more like a toxin that eats at your insides.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of On the Nature of Human Romantic Interaction, the debut collection by Carl Yanyema. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What do you do with the BA in English? What is my life going to be?
On the next Fresh Air, songwriters Robert Lopez and Jeff Marx of the Tony Award-winning Broadway musical Avenue Q. It's about wisecracking 30-something puppets with low expectations.